Hey, what's going on, everyone? Welcome to the Over the Cap podcast. It is Labor Day, September 7th, 2020, and this is Jason Fitzgerald. You can find me on Twitter at Jason_OTC. Obviously, I'm coming late this week. You guys probably won't listen to this until Tuesday or Wednesday. But with all the transactions that were going on, there was just so much stuff that we had to do to, rip apart the rosters and then rebuild them up with the practice squad players and everything else. That I figured it made a little bit more sense to just hold off on the podcast just from a time constraint perspective, as well as just kind of getting an idea a little bit more as to where the roster stands. So real quick, first, just a couple of updates that we've got on the website. We do have the salary cap pages now fully updated for the information that we have. You know, there's still information that's outstanding. You know, there's a Clowney signing, there's a couple of extensions we don't have details on. There's some restructures in San Francisco that we don't have details on. I think the Raiders restructured someone. I don't have details on that yet. The Rams will be restructuring someone. They're definitely over the cap right now. So there's still stuff that's going to be trickling in, but we do have the cap pages now updated for the 53-man rosters, all the players on injured reserve, practice squad players as of Sunday are all uploaded in. Maybe one or two mistakes here or there, but most of those players should be correct now. We've switched over all the accounting rules to regular season rules. So the top 51 rule is in effect basically until Thursday, I think. It's either Wednesday or Thursday. I think it's Thursday. But we just switch it over now just because we're in the regular season mode. So while we will see a couple of players who are on IR probably take settlements this week and get knocked down from the rosters to increase cap space, this is basically the lay of the land as to where stuff is going to be. On top of that, if you go to the 2021 salary cap pages, either on the cap space page team or on the team pages, you'll notice that we brought the salary cap down to more reasonable expectations. A lot of people have been asking me questions about this. So what I did was I actually reached out to a number of people who work within the NFL just to kind of get some feedback as to where they thought the cap would be next year. Overwhelming consensus is that it's going to be 175. I put it as 176. I did get two replies that were a little bit above the 175 mark. So I figured, all right, you know what? I'll do 176 or 177 and put them in there. Secondly, we do have estimated carryover cap numbers in here. So when you go to the cap space page and you see the New Orleans Saints at 69.8 million over the cap based on the amount of players on the roster, 74.4 million over the cap based on their effective cap space. Effective cap space means what would happen if they had to bring the roster up to 51 players. What would their cap space be at that point in time? That includes carryover from 2020 as to where things are at the moment. So we'll update those carryover numbers during the course of the season. As big deals come in and cap space changes, obviously the carryover is impacted that way. But going into next year, you've basically got a handful of teams that are in really good shape. Jaguars, Colts, Jets, Patriots. As you get down a little bit, the quote-unquote football team, Chargers, Ravens. Those teams will be okay. And the teams that are going to have trouble next year, the Saints, the Eagles, the Falcons, the Chiefs, the Raiders, the Texans, the Steelers, Vikings. Those are all going to be the teams that have a little bit of trouble. The Packers. Those are the ones that are all going to have bigger decisions to make unless something changes dramatically between now and the end of the season in terms of fans being allowed into stadiums. That will increase the values of stuff. Tons of extensions came down in the last couple of days. That's pretty typical. We see this a lot year after year. Based on all these little different things. So you've got Joe Mixon signed 4 years, $48 million. That's a nice contract for him. If you break down the numbers on the Mixon extension, if you subscribe to the premium and you use the player comparison tool and you want to compare him very quickly to Derrick Henry, you'll see this is a stronger contract for Joe Mixon than it was for Derrick Henry. Mixon's a good player. There's no doubt about that. He's It's kind of anonymous because he plays in Cincinnati. And yes, it's a whole running back thing and everything else. This is a team, I always consider it a very different situation when you have a rookie quarterback and you want to overspend on this position. It's a little bit more okay to do. The other thing is, and a little different this year for the Bengals because they did go out in free agency and spend, but for a team that usually doesn't do that, re-signing a running back to a bigger contract really not that big of a deal. You know, people will get on that because there's no guarantee in the contract. There's only the signing bonus, which is $10 million. It's the way the Bengals do business. Look, if the Bengals sign him to a four-year deal, he's going to play at least 3 years of that contract. Doesn't matter what the guarantees are. The Bengals chase sunk costs more than any team in the NFL. In some cases, you know, when the Bengals had decent teams, nothing wrong with that strategy. When the team has been bad, sometimes you do have to make some more changes, but they don't do that. They usually look at the fact and say, hey, we paid this guy $10 million up front and we paid him X amount of dollars for the first 2 years. We're definitely getting 3 years out of the deal no matter what. Nice little contract there. Taylor Decker gets an extension in Detroit. That one threw me off. There were so many different numbers that came out, and I have no idea how his agency could tweet the wrong numbers out. I guess that's what happens when you have number of agents that work on a deal, and then everything filters through an organization, and then it gets to the marketing people, and they have no idea what there is to read in a contract. Basically, they reported a six-year deal for whatever. It sounded like a blowaway deal. That's not the case here. It's a market value deal. Basically comes in under $15 million. Again, when you compare it, the big thing here is what I wasn't sure of when this deal came down, and once the actual numbers came out, on the extension that was here, I didn't know if it was going to end up being like that Dawkins contract that we talked about last week, or 2 weeks ago, whenever it was, that just blew me away with how strong the cash flows were, up front on that one. And this one is completely different because I didn't know if that was going to lead to something becoming kind of the standard in the NFL, that these left tackle contracts after the Tunsil one were maybe going to take a different move, a different way of growth, but that's not the case. So Decker basically gets a $4 million raise this year. He'll get only $17 million through year one. As a comparison, Dawkins will get 29, $32 million through year two for Decker, 38 for Dawkins. 45 through year 46 through year three for Decker versus 48 for Dawkins, and then they make the turn 59 to 58, if that's correct here. There might be a little something off on this. Let me just see. Oh wait, no, he has a void year. I'm sorry, they have a second year in there. It is a 4 year contract, but there's a void year at the back end of this one. So it's not until year four that he passes Dawkins, and I think this is really the reason why the Lions probably did it, is the fact that it's so light on cash up front. It gives them a little bit more salary cap flexibility. And again, it's light up front. I got a lot of people that weren't crazy about the deal. I don't really see the big deal of it. Left tackles are getting a bunch of money. He's not a bad player. He's not a great player. But if you're going to extend him, you look at DJ Humphries, who got the three-year deal. You look at a couple other guys. If you're a passable left tackle, you're going to get paid. So the question just becomes, do you want to have your passable left tackle? You hope maybe he gets better. Or do you want to go back in the draft and do you want to start over again? Because there's really no such thing as a cheap left tackle. Can you go out there and can you find a guy who's been cut and, you know, maybe towards the end of his career and maybe you get a season or two out of him? You might. I mean, you might be able to kind of get that surprise player, but the odds are pretty much against it. So I didn't really have any problems with this one. 37.5, pretty much guaranteed right up front. There's a little bit of some funky structuring in this one. Not that different than the Travis Kelce one, in terms of the way the guarantees work. But you know, if he does fall apart, Detroit's got some flexibility in that deal to make some changes and everything in there. So that was one of the deals that came in. Ryan Kelly signed an extension, $12 million, a little under 12.5 a year. Center contracts are stale. They're just not moving at all. You're not going to get any better than him, and his contract just really isn't pushing much anything. It's heavy up front, which is I'm sure why they took the deal, but there's not much. When you looked at that deal, when I looked at it, I didn't see anything there that said, wow, you know, he should definitely take this this contract. You know, he's considered such a good player. You know, Mitch Morse last year as a free agent also got a four-year deal for 11.1. You look at the cash flows on these, so he'll get a $5 million raise this year. But through the first year, his and the Morse contract are basically the same, 1965 versus 1945. Morse will be higher in through year two, 28 to 27. Then it takes the turn in year three, 37 to 35, and then 49 to 44. And while we do say that, yes, there are certainly a lot of players, when you push the market, you say, okay, that's where the turn belongs. Usually that's because the player isn't as good as the player that they're surpassing, right? The main difference is that they're signing later. So it would be the equivalent of, let's say you flip this around and you said, you know, well, Mitch Morse is a free agent and the Ryan Kelly contract is, say, 3 years old. You would come up with a way for him to surpass that, but maybe it wouldn't be until year three that it makes that turn. This is the opposite way. You've got the much better player. You have contracts that in timeline, in terms of the frame on the timeline, are basically the same. You know, a 2019 deal versus 2020 deal. Is the coronavirus an impact? Yeah, probably not. You know, you're a great player. Great players, this stuff doesn't impact you. So that's a terrific deal for Indianapolis, I think. I think that's a really solid deal for them. For Kelly, it's a mediocre deal. I think there was more that they could have gotten out of it. But, you know, if you want to go into the season and you want to get some kind of security, you know, that's a good thing. He didn't get, as far as I know, he did not get a signing bonus. Did get a roster bonus in there. So that should be protected in the event that the season is cut short somewhat. But not that big of a deal. Big deal that comes down, obviously, is the Deshaun Watson deal. I was out when this one broke through. Not surprised in the least to see the numbers. I was shocked the day before when people were talking about this contract online, Ian Rappaport and, you know, the usual group of people, basically saying that they heard a deal was close, but that it was along the lines of Russell Wilson and not Patrick Mahomes. And that made no sense to me at all. You know, I've been on the record on this plenty of times saying, I think Deshaun Watson should get somewhere close to $40 million a year. Lo and behold, what did Deshaun Watson get? Right around $40 million a year. I have no clue where in the world they were coming from, where that information was coming from. Unless it was coming from Houston and what they were trying to say was, yeah, you know, we're not up to 45. This deal blows away the Mahomes contract. And this is why we were critical of the Mahomes deal, which essentially is, like we said, you know, it's trading in the possibilities here for greatness. But you kind of give up, I think, a bit on the money aspect here. So this is, I'm not going to say it's a complete game changer, but it's a pretty big one. It does not surpass the Wilson contract in the front end. The Wilson contract was really great on the front end. This is kind of somewhere in between. And I guess the reason for that was that Wilson had, they had very different goals in mind on that deal, which they weren't going to get. And I think this was kind of like a happy medium for them to get to. So Wilson got $71 million through the first new year of his deal. Deshaun Watson will be at 55. Patrick Mahomes is just 35.45. No comparison between the two. Through year two, Deshaun Watson will make $92 million. That sets a new mark that beats the Wilson mark of 90. So we've got the turn on this one in year two. That's legitimate. That's a way that, you know, players go. This is a legitimate market mover. This isn't just fiddling with numbers to make something happen. Through year three, he'll have 124. Mahomes is just 113.85. Through year four, he will out-earn Mahomes, 156 to 155.8. Russell Wilson is left in the dust at that point. He's at 140. So these are all the numbers that I thought were going to be for Patrick Mahomes on his original deal before he took that 8 million year one. So Watson is going to make the same exact money as Mahomes, and he's going to have a chance 5 years from now to renegotiate and get a new deal. Now, Mahomes is going to be stuck on his contract for many, many, many years. Now, the second part of Mahomes' contract is going to average more money. It's going to average close to 50. The question is, can Watson get there? And I would say it seems like a lock. That would be the case, assuming, of course, that, you know, he's a good player. let me just open up, just to give you an idea here. I know we went over this before, but I just want to run through some of the contracts. So I'm just going to pull up the active contracts here. So we had our first $40 million contract in 2020. And Watson's also pretty close to that. So let's say 2020 gets us just about to the $40 million barrier in terms of real contracts. So if you want to go back, your first $30 million player was in 2018. So it only took us 2 years to get from 30 to 40. To get from 20 to 30 took us about six, I think. I think 2012 was Drew Brees was the first $20 million quarterback. Let me look up his contract history. Drew Brees, 2012. Yeah, he just hit the $20 million number. So it took us until 2012 to get to $20 million. Then it took us to 2018 to get to 30. It only took us to 2020 to basically get to 40. So I have to imagine 5 years from now, we'll definitely be at 50, if not more. So as long as Watson, you know, remains healthy and continues to play well, he's going to blow away Mahomes' career earnings just based on the fact that this is the way they did the deal. Now, is there a thing in this that you look at and you say for the Texans that they did something good here? I think this is where they had to end up no matter what. You know, the best thing that worked out for the Texans here is at least they got a fourth year. I thought the fact that they only did three on Tunsil was going to impact them and that they were really going to get sunk by having to do a 3 year for Watson. So I think it's good that they at least got to the regular part of the market on the 4 year. And I don't think you can kill them for the you know, the annual value on this deal. To be honest, I haven't even looked at this one that close. Let's take a look at how the cap numbers work out on it. See if there's anything that's kind of funky here. Let's see. Watson, 9.8 this year, 15.9. So you can see it's the same thing all these teams are doing. They're making sure the cap number is low after that. Smart strategy by his agent. He's got high cap numbers in 2022 and 2023. So even though I think guarantees mean nothing for quarterbacks, you're putting the team in a situation to where they may have to take a large portion of either a roster bonus or a base salary, convert it to a bonus to bring his cap number down. And then that protects you for the rest of the contract if that's what you're looking for. So it's a pretty good deal, you know, for all parties, because they don't fall victim now to the fact that maybe the Cowboys and Dak Prescott have something else that happens next year. Dallas is probably the biggest loser in all this one. I think they needed to get a deal done before the Watson deal came in. Didn't happen. So, you know, they're now going to have to deal with the fact that the market is at the point 4 years is pretty much going to be the standard, which is all right. They have the franchise tag year. So in Dallas's case, they're going to look at any deal they do with him as being a plus one. So in other words, if Dallas has to go to 40 to over four, you know, they'll add in this year's number. I think it's 31 is the number, you know, divide that by five. That'll work out to an average annual value of 38.2. That'll be the APY on the deal. So they may look at it that way. But Dallas lost out. Dallas could have gotten a stronger deal probably if they did a four-year contract now, if they had done it ahead of time and just gotten it in. I think there were things that could have been done on that to get it done, but I would consider them the biggest loser. I would consider the Chiefs the biggest winner in all this, because if this deal had come in before Kansas City did their deal, and I think it would have. You know, some people say, well, they needed Mahomes to get here. I don't think that's the case, because the Texans with the Tunsil deal and a couple others maybe here and there, but mainly the Tunsil deal, they're not going to be in a position to, you know, to where they're just relying on other numbers. You know, they've been willing to push in certain cases, and this is one of them. So I think he would have gotten here regardless. You know, I think the only thing was the Mahomes deal, because of the way the front end on that deal worked. I think that blocked off Watson from $40 million a year. But, you know, this is pretty much a great consolation prize. So congratulations to him. And, you know, to the Texans as well, you've got stability at your quarterback position, and that's what you need to be a successful franchise from this point forward. But, yeah, that was a pretty big one. Other big news story was Jadeveon Clowney is finally going to sign. He's going to end up with the Tennessee Titans. There were a lot of different things that were going on this week for teams trying to sign him and fit him under their cap. Basically, you had the Baltimore Ravens. They were rumored to be in discussions with the Jacksonville Jaguars to basically have the Jaguars sign Clowney and use up their cap room and then trade him, you know, to another team. Then it was the Saints who were trying to do whatever they could to create cap space to sign him. There was no way the Saints could do it. Apparently the Saints then approached the Cleveland Browns and said, hey, what do you think about signing Clowney, paying him, you know, a couple million dollars of his salary, then trading him to us, and, you know, we'll give you a second round pick or whatever it is in return. The league apparently said no on this. I don't really understand the logic too much behind it. This is a thing that I've talked about on the podcast years and years and years ago. I wish I could find it, and I thought I could have found an article. I know talked about it somewhere in writing. Might have been discussions on Chase Stewart's site on Football Perspective years ago. But the basic concept, I think he was talking about it more as for draft selections, maybe. I was looking at it more from the perspective, I think, in free agency. It's just a question of where you value the cost of picks. And I would have been under what some other people thought on it. But basically, what you would do is you would be signing a player for another team to use your cap room. You know, you have a bigger budget. So you'll eat some of that cost, and then you'll just trade him to the other team, and in return, you get a draft pick for it. There's no rule in the CBA that really should prohibit you from doing this. And in reality, we've seen this happen before, right? Where have we seen it happen before? Well, the biggest one was Sam Bradford. Sam Bradford signed with the Philadelphia Eagles. He was a free agent. He signed with the Eagles. Now, he had originally been a member of the Eagles, so he technically signed an extension. But he was going to be a free agent. He signed with the Eagles, and the Eagles went and drafted Carson Wentz, and he was very unhappy. And next thing you know, the Vikings had a quarterback injury, and they called up the Eagles, and it was a heist for the Eagles. They got Sam Bradford off the team, and they sent him to Minnesota. He technically never played a snap for the Eagles on that contract. The Eagles ended up paying a good portion of his salary just to get him to go to Minnesota. We've also seen a number of trades take place where teams have had to restructure contracts or renegotiate contracts where they eat the cost on part of the deal in order to facilitate a trade to another team that doesn't have the cap space for it. So we've seen the situations play out. Now, the question, I guess, is for the league to say no, they won't allow this. I think the reason for that is those situations were kind of organic, right? You have these trades that come up where, you know, the player got a tryout with the team, player was part of the team, the player lasted with the team, you know, Osweiler to Cleveland, you know, fulfilled part of the contract. The contract itself was negotiated in good faith. And there are a lot of sections in the collective bargaining agreement that talk about you can't have consideration between clubs, meaning you can't put restrictions on free agency. And I think the point here, and even though it doesn't hold in these cases, because in these cases, this was going to be Clowney negotiating with the Saints, with the Browns acting as a middleman. But in reality, I think what you don't want to have happen is the situation where essentially teams are controlling the rights of a player. So let's say that Clowney had no desire whatsoever to play with New Orleans. He didn't like Sean Payton. He didn't want to go there. And, you know, this was his deal. He wanted to go and play in Jacksonville. And Jacksonville negotiates in good faith with him, you know, to get him to sign a deal. While behind his back, They're calling up New Orleans on the phone, and they're saying, hey, listen, you know, we'll do this deal for this guy. We'll give him a $10 million signing bonus. You only got to pay him $4 million, but we want a late first-round pick. Okay, you know, they'll do it. And that kind of takes the freedom out of free agency for a player. That's a different scenario than, I think, a good-faith negotiation where you've given up your right on the trade protection, but for whatever reason, something happens, like the situation with Bradford and the Eagles, to where things change and they end up trading you. So I think there's that aspect of it, and I think that's why they came in. And this is where sometimes I think you have to be just a little bit smarter with the way that you do stuff, that you don't want to do things overt that can maybe be considered against the spirit of the rules. I think if the Jaguars had signed Clowney 3 weeks ago with the full intention of trading him, but they signed him, say, 3 weeks ago, and he went through training camp with Jacksonville, and then on the eve of the season they traded him to the Saints, they would have let it go through. Might there have been an eyebrow or two raised? Yeah, there might have been. But I think, for the most part, the league would have let it go through. I think this one was... it was just the way that it was handled. It was probably almost as if you were negotiating between teams for the rights to a player who wasn't under contract, which technically you can't do. So I'm going to guess that's why they didn't let it happen. I think they should let deals like this happen as long as the players agree to it. You know, there are things you can put in with no trades and different stuff like that as well to protect them. Now, could the Saints have still done a deal? Yeah, I think so. I think if the Saints really wanted to do this, I think the Saints could have, within the rules that definitely would have been in place, I think they could have done it. And what would you do? So I think what you would have to do if you were the Saints to get around this kind of rule, what you'd need to do is create cap room, right? You need to create cap space, and you don't know how to do it. You need someone else to eat some money. So what would you do? I think what you would have to do is you would go and you would basically take a player like a Demario Davis or a Sheldon Rankins, you know, someone who's got, you know, guarantees on the salary. And basically you go and you trade those players to Jacksonville or Cleveland, whomever the case may be. And the Cleveland Browns would be the team on the hook for that. So let's just say that you traded a Rankins to Cleveland and his salary is $7.7 million. You send him to Cleveland and, you know, you know full well he's coming back and you're not going to trade him back. But the way that this would work, and, you know, you have to assume that the agents are going to be willing and able to do this. And maybe you could do a trade back even too. But what you would basically have happen is you would trade the player to Cleveland. Cleveland would turn around and release the player a couple days later. Cleveland would be on the hook for that salary. So let's say they're willing to eat $6 million, you know, because there'd be offsets on the guarantee. So they would take a cap charge this year of 7.7. The Saints would re-sign Rankins for a one-year deal for $1 million. And that million would get credited back to the Browns because of the offset. And so basically they would have eaten 6.6 for you for a player you re-signed in free agency. And, you know, in the meantime, you would have, as you made that trade, you know, you would have sent something over. So you would have sent over, say, Rankins and a second round pick in return for just somebody on the roster or a conditional seventh round draft selection or something, you know, some player on there. And I don't think they would have been able to get in the way of that. I think they could have, I think you could have done a deal like that and you probably could have gotten it to work. But I think the league is stupid for not allowing this to happen. I think it would make the league a lot more fun. I think it would make it a lot more interesting. You know, as long as you always have a situation where, even if the standard NFL contract became something along the lines of, you know, if you're going to trade a player in the year of signing, that he has to agree to the trade, well, then that takes away your consideration aspect of it. So I think there were ways around it. I think there were things they could do, and I think the league should kind of open up their mind to this. So That was just a couple of things on the signings. There were other deals that have come down as well. Cam Hayward today, and you know, a couple other contracts, and we'll get to those next week. Hopefully, we'll get to them. Some other stuff I put online. If you go to OTC, you'll see we have a breakdown of the rosters this year for each team. I like to do these. These I think are always pretty interesting. So the average age of the rosters this year, just 26, just a little over 26 years old. Bears have the oldest team in the NFL. I don't usually include quarterbacks in these. The 49ers are the second oldest, followed by the Titans, Saints, Bills, Cardinals. Youngest teams are the Dolphins, Rams, Vikings, Browns. Jaguars are pretty young too. Yeah, breakdowns by draft status. I always find those interesting as well because people always think the draft is the end-all be-all. It's really not. You know, the seventh and sixth round selections, you know, it's always kind of interesting to see how many players stick with their teams. So I looked at the drafts from 2016 to 2020. Seventh rounders, just 3% are still on the team that drafted them, that were drafted in 2016, 20% from 2017, 47% from 2018, only 45% from 2019, and 63% from 2020. So nearly 40% of the seventh round picks were cut this year or traded away or whatever. Sixth round picks, more of the same, only 6.5% from 2016 re-signed with their team. Only 23% from 2017 are still in the league, and so on and so forth. You know, so that's just an interesting thing. We've got a look at, you know, the players by round on each team. You know, undrafteds make up the majority of the NFL. That's obvious, you know, because there's so many undrafted players. Look, the rate of an undrafted making a roster is really low. It's probably about 15%. So it's far lower than, you know, if the round seven is 63%, round six is 77%, round five is 88% this year. It's only 15% for an undrafted to make a roster, 94% for round five. You know, it's not a big number of undrafteds that make the final rosters for a team. You know, in any given year, you've probably got 10 or 11% of a undrafted class that's actually on an active NFL roster. So it's, you know, it's definitely not the same level of success as a draft pick. You know, so it's not that, but you know, it's an important part of an NFL team. You know, that your depth does not come through the draft for the most part. You fill out your roster with guys who weren't drafted. So it's always important to look for those diamonds in the rough. It's tougher this year because of the lack of practice. Now the practice squads have expanded to 16. So, you're going to see more and more of those players in there. Got to look at homegrown players, you know, players who basically have spent their entire careers with the team. Ravens and Vikings at the top of that list with 80%. Packers usually are at the top. They're at 76% this year, and that's just because they've been a little more active in free agency the last 2 years. Bengals are down to 67%, and again, same concept. They were a little bit more active in free agency. So that brought down who are, you know, those teams that are typically right around 80% as well. You know, Ravens, Patriots, they have tons of players on other teams. They just do such a tremendous job, not just in terms of scouting talent, but in development of players. So those kind of players are always very sought after when you go through claims and when teams are looking for, you know, players just to give a tryout to. They look at those as, you know, being important. As we move into 2020, you know, the Bills, the Colts, the Steelers, Buccaneers, Texans, Saints, Chiefs, Packers, and 49ers, and the Cardinals are all the teams that will be returning at least 75% of their snaps from last season on offense and defense. That's a pretty good number. The low-end Panthers, just 44%, Patriots, 54%, Jets, 57%. They're the only teams under 60%. Dolphins 62, Lions 62, Cowboys 63, Seahawks 64, the Washington football team 64, and the Browns are just under 65. So there's very little continuity there between those teams. When you look at the teams that are going to rely on players who are either rookies or were injured and just didn't play much last year, the Patriots, Vikings, Rams, Panthers, Packers, Cowboys, 49ers, they're all need to get those types of players to basically make up about 19% of their snaps from last year. So that'll those are the kind of teams that you'd say, okay, you know, they have these veteran players there, but they're also going to be relying on a lot of very unproven players, whether it's through the draft or players that were signed that maybe didn't get a big opportunity elsewhere. You know, so that's just one of the things. Rather than rehashing the whole thing, you can just go to OTC and you can check that out for yourself, the Breaking Down the 53-Man Rosters article. So now we make that little turn to the regular season, and I'm hoping we have the full season. You know, everything has gone pretty good with the stuff through camp so far, but, you know, the big test is just going to be the travel. You know, how are things going to go when teams travel? And so you're going to, you know, go from there and see how things work out. But it's always fun to look ahead to the season and, you know, make some really bad predictions. So why not do that? you know, let's do some really bad prediction stuff here, and we'll go through some of the teams. So, you know, basically when I look at the seasons, if I really want to pay attention to it, I usually break teams down into four buckets, kind of four bins, if you want to call them that, buckets, bins, groups, whatever you want to call them. And, you know, basically I look at them in a couple different categories. So one, we look at the really bad teams from last year. All right. Really, what are the real bad teams? We'll start with them. Really bad teams are the teams that were under 5 wins last year. So the teams that fit into that category last year were the, let's see, the Dolphins, Chargers, Panthers, Giants, Lions, football team, and Bengals. These are the teams that typically have the biggest improvement, though, year over year. Your average gain on these teams is close to 3 wins, a little bit under that. You know, probably about 2.8, 2.7 wins is your average gain that you would see. Let me just double check something here. I just want to make sure I have one of these teams right. Just hold on 1 second while I just open something here. Okay, yeah, I just wanted to open up a couple of the finances here on that. You know, so what do I look for in terms of what some of those teams have done in the off seasons? And, you know, you kind of look to see where they spent their money, how they decided to spend it. You know, typically if really bad teams go crazy on offensive spending, it's usually a bad thing. In general, for a lot of teams, sometimes spending really crazy on offense is not good. Only because, you know, if you've spent a lot on offense, and this goes for really all groups of teams, probably means your offense wasn't that good to begin with. And on offense, unlike on defense, you don't see the difference-making players really ever get to free agency. So you're basically overpaying for a lot of talent. Teams that spend a lot on defense usually actually improve a little bit more. And I think the reason for that has to do with you have talent level that's a little bit higher that comes in defensively. The other thing is that where offense is somewhat consistent year to year because of the impact of the quarterback position, you know, defenses aren't. So if you change the mix on defense, and you're probably at a bad defense the year before, you know, things probably improve. And if you've spent money on defense and free agency, probably meant that you spent a little bit more time in the draft focusing on your offense, which is where your improvement's going to come from. More is going to come from that. So if you look at these teams, you know, I think the two teams that stand out that I think will you know, probably have some difficulties here, I think would be the Panthers and the Chargers. I think those would be the teams that, you know, it's hard to say the Chargers should get worse. You know, I wouldn't think so. You know, just looking at them overall, you would think they would be better, but, you know, you look at what they've spent. They really didn't do much in terms of spending. You know, they really didn't add a lot in that regard. They have a developmental prospect at quarterback. You know, you like the coaching staff, I think, that's there. But I don't know. They have the makings of teams that typically get worse, not better. Panthers would also be in that category. They spent a bunch of money on offense. They're not very good. I think that's certainly the case. They're ripping apart their roster. They added a quarterback, and I know a lot of people like Bridgewater, but he's not great. You added money in Bridgewater, you added money in Robbie Anderson. You're really hoping to change some stuff, and I'm not sure that'll really work out. You added a lot of money on your defensive line, though. That's usually one of the worst positions. It's a position where you gain value, but you don't want to add a lot on it. You just overpay for stuff that's not really impact. So I think if I had to take two teams from this mix who I think would get worse, I guess it would be those two teams. So if you're looking at a five wins on those seasons, maybe they would get a little bit worse. I'm still a little torn on saying that with the Chargers, but just looking at their off season and everything there, they lost James already to injury. That would be worrisome a little bit. The Dolphins, I think, have potential to improve a lot. You look at, how they've spent, they added a lot to their secondary, which is always important. They added at cornerback. That's big. They added at safety. That's pretty good as well. They brought in a linebacker. They brought in some pass rushers. I think when you add all these things up, I think you're looking at a team that definitely can get, certainly into that competing maybe for a wild card spot. Now, the big trick with them is going to be Fitzpatrick. How long are you going to go with Fitzpatrick before you turn to the rookie? I don't know how healthy the rookie is. Fitzpatrick, it was fun last year. He never puts together back-to-back seasons. That would be a little bit worrisome, but they've added other stuff to where I think that, that could be a team that improves a little bit from last season. The Giants, I don't really have a lot of high hopes for them. I don't think they'll be much better. I don't think they'll be much worse. I think the big thing that helps them out is you do have a new coach. I think new coaches take leagues by surprise very, very often. Can Daniel Jones be a better player? He shows flashes here and there. It's possible. They were a 4-win team last year. They're probably going to be a 6-7 win team this year, but maybe there's some things that could, help them out and make that change. Detroit, they had 3.5 wins last year. They get their quarterback. They've added a ton of players on defense. So you would imagine that should make them, much better. They've tried to improve their offensive line a little bit. You have to imagine this is a team that should get back to that 7-win mark. I don't know if Detroit has any potential of competing for the playoffs. I don't think the coaching staff is good enough there. I don't think the players are good enough there. Stafford, I think, has always been overrated as a quarterback because he was drafted first overall. I know he had a nice season last year before he got hurt. I don't know if that's going to happen again, to that level. But he should be able to get you to that 7 or 8-win level. 8-win plateau. And one of these teams will make a playoff run. Could they in that division? That division could be down. So I guess you can't say definitely no on that one. But they should get up. Washington, I have very low expectations for them. Just really low. I just don't see much there. They only had 3 last year. I wouldn't be surprised if they end up very similar. The Bengals should be better than a 2-win team. A lot's going to depend on the rookie. If the rookie plays incredibly well, they have a chance to really improve. They added, they did add to their secondary and everything else. My guess is that they'll probably be looking at 5 or 6 wins next season. That's probably what you'll get from that group. From our second group, typically these are the teams that, kind of stay status quo most of the time. You don't get, too much in the way of change here. So you got the Cowboys, the Bears, the Steelers, Raiders, Falcons, Colts, Jets, Broncos, Bucks, Jags, Browns, and Cardinals. These are all the teams that were 5.5 wins or more, 5.5 to 8 wins last year. Basically all those teams that were on the playoffs, the outside looking in. You know, the Cardinals are an interesting team to me. They're a complete boom or bust team. They didn't add much in the offseason that would make you think they're going to be much better. I think the question is, how much can the quarterback grow this year? He certainly showed a lot of flashes last year in terms of being able to improve. They've been very bullish on a couple of extensions that I didn't really understand too much, but you know, it is what it is when it comes to that. You know, typically, you know, teams that, you know, don't spend, which is where they are, you know, you usually you don't improve that much at all. So any improvement here is just you're just banking on the quarterback. So it really just depends on what you see there. And I think you have so many different outcomes. This is one of those teams that I bet could be as low as 4. You know, probably could be as high as 10. Just very dependent on that quarterback. But if the quarterback doesn't take that step in the second year, this is probably a bad football team. There's not a lot of talent, I think, on that roster otherwise. So it's all dependent on him. The Browns, you know, the Browns still are trying to, you know, fix up that offense a little bit. You know, they added a lot of small parts on defense, which is, you know, basically okay. You know, they added a lot of parts all across the board, I guess. Just looking at it here, but most of their stuff has been spent, you know, on, you know, they spent a lot on a tight end. I didn't really understand that part. They got backup quarterback, sign a tackle. You know, it just like with Murray, it's very similar kind of stuff. You know, you're depending a lot on Baker Mayfield. They should compete for the playoffs this year. I think they'll be improved from 6, but I don't think that they're going to take that leap into being a division contender. You know, the question is, can they get to 9? Can they get to 10? This is another boom or bust team because they have a lot of explosive personalities on this team. How the coach is going to handle that, you know, that's important as well. Last coach didn't handle it very well. So, you know, I think this is probably going to be somewhere around a 500 football team. Jacksonville has completely dismantled themselves. They were 6-win team last year. I would say most people are probably assuming they'll be a 1 or 2 win team this year. I don't know if they'll be that bad, but they'll be pretty close to that. So they're probably going to be about a 3-win team. Buccaneers are another one of those teams that, you know, you look at and you say, well, you know, everything, they added the big quarterback name and people are really high on them right now. I don't know. Part of me wants to buy into the hype. The other part of me wants to say that, you know, you're adding a player at tight end who hasn't played in a year. You're adding a 43-year-old quarterback in Tom Brady, who is not the same player he used to be. I don't know. You focused a lot on adding to an offense when you really didn't need to. Now, I'm not saying that they needed to double down on Winston. This is, you know, maybe this is the better move for them, that this gives you a higher potential for the short term. And if it flops, at least you're not locked into anything more than one more season. And then you can start to move forward by, you know, going back in the draft and going somewhere else. They were at 7 wins last year. You know, this is either going to be a 11-win team, or this is going to be a team that just gets murdered on defense and doesn't click on offense to where Brady is not making the best use of the players that are there. I don't know. I have a hard time with them, and I'm actually going to lean more on the side that they're probably going to be a 7-win, 8-win team. I'm not feeling it at all. The Broncos have 7-win team last year. everything, you know, again, depends a lot on the quarterback. I love a lot of the pieces they have on offense. You know, they try to improve their line with some guards. You know, obviously they had the running back in free agency. Didn't really add anything on defense. That defense has been pretty consistent, though. So you might say that that's not as big of a deal for them as it is for other teams. I think they'll contend for not necessarily the division, but I think they will flirt with being a 10-win team. So I kind of like some of the things they did. The Jets, I'm just not feeling it. They've revamped their offensive line, which hopefully will be good. But you know, they drafted a guy who is really going to take one of the spots of one of their bigger free agent signings. So not exactly sure of the plan that's there. A lot of negativity coming out of training camp. I've been kind of surprised by that. They were overrated at 7 last year. I think if they can get to 7 this year, it would actually be a very successful season. I think they're probably more along the lines of a 5-win team. Colts, their big thing is adding Phillip Rivers. Beyond that, you know, they added Buckner. He might make some kind of impact as well. Obviously, they're going to hope for that. Rivers is an interesting player, interesting quarterback. There are times where he just kind of, I don't know, just at the end of games, you just feel like there's something missing there. So I don't know. I think the Colts will probably be right around 500. I don't think they'll be a team that takes a step forward. Atlanta, I don't like Atlanta at all. I think they're, you know, just kind of overvalued on a lot of things. I think they made a mistake with not switching out, their coach. So they're a 7-win team. You know, they're a team where if they get off to a slow start, they're going to completely crumble. If they get off to a fast start, you know, they could be a 7, 8, 9-win team again. I watch a lot to see how they do at the beginning. The Raiders have added a lot of players in free agency this year. They were at 7 wins the last season. They should be improved. I don't think there's any reason why they shouldn't, you know, be 8, 7, 8, 9-win team. You know, a little bit better. But I don't think that's a team that really can make a big jump forward. The one place where they could jump, most people know that I've been a Carr fan, but I think if for some reason they can coach up Mariota and then catch lightning in a bottle with him at some point, I think that's actually their higher ceiling, is if they come in there with him. I don't know if they'll ever get to him, but I would say that gives them the higher ceiling with him as a player. The Steelers, I like. They're going to have all kinds of salary cap issues next year. They were an 8-win team this year. They didn't add at all in free agency. They rarely ever do. But they get their quarterback back. Roethlisberger is close to being himself. I would imagine that this is definitely a 10-win team. I think they definitely can compete with the Ravens for the division. That defense is really good. I think that they will still be good this year. I think next year it could be a wheels fall off kind of season, but I like the Steelers to be, you know, 10, 11 wins. Bears were 8 last year. Man, they just named Trubisky their starter. I don't know if most people would have been that excited about Foles anyway. They added a lot on defense again. I guess the question is, will that get their defense back to being a dominant level? Because that offense is going nowhere. You know, maybe for, you know, last year Trubisky didn't run as much, didn't use his athleticism to his advantage. Maybe they'll do a little more of that on offense. I can't see them scoring at all. So it just depends on their defense. I don't see them being a really bad team, though. I kind of think it'll be status quo with them. I think they'll be 8 wins, you know, and that's where that'll be. Dallas, I like Dallas. I think Dallas has a lot going for it this year. I think that Dallas very, very well could win the NFC East. They were 8 last year. They should have been higher. They've added, you know, some important pieces this year. I know Clinton Dix didn't work out and Gerald McCoy did not work out. for them, but they've added some parts. I think the coaching will make a big difference for this year. I think they just needed a new voice. I think Prescott's going to come in. I think Prescott's going to look terrific. I think Dallas is an 11 or 12 win team this season. I think of these teams, that is the team that will probably make the biggest leap out of all of them. When you get to the next group, this is where you start to get into teams that regress a little bit more. You know, where you get into the playoff teams, either the Bills, Vikings, Texans, Rams, Eagles, and Titans. So from this group here that you look at, I think the Vikings by far are the team that's going to regress the most. I did not understand the Ngakoue signing too much. I thought that kind of set back whatever stuff they had done that I thought was impressive in terms of planning for the future. I thought that was two steps back with this trade right here. So I was not really crazy about that at all. Their offense is okay. They were 10 last year. I think this is a team that'll drop two further back. I think they'll probably be an 8-win team. Texans were a 10-win team. I think they'll still be a 10-win team. I don't think that they will change much at all. I'd be shocked if they were below 9. I'd be shocked if they're above 11. I think they pretty much are what they are. They're always going to be one of those teams that you look at that shows some flashes on offense, is inconsistent and probably doesn't get to that next level in the playoffs. Buffalo Bills are interesting. They were a 10-win team last year. They've added more on their defense. They signed, they also re-signed Tre'Davious White. I forgot to mention him earlier. I think their defense will be as good as last year, if not a little bit better. I think their offense, even though they added Diggs, I still think is going to be a problem. I am not on the Josh Allen for MVP bandwagon. I don't think he throws well enough. I just don't see that at all. I think this year where you have expectations, there's going to be a lot more on his plate. They're well coached. They're pretty well run at the moment. I think they'll fall back a little bit. I don't think they'll fall back very far. Now, if Allen does take off this year, then yeah, you're probably looking at a team that has the makings of, someone that can win 11 or 12 games. I think more likely this is probably a 9-win team this year. You have the Rams, who were a 9-win team last year. They cut a lot of payroll, made a couple of changes here and there. There's some people who are down too much on the Rams, but I don't think you're going to see a lot of giant improvement from them, though, either. They were a 9-win team last year. I think they'll be 8 or 9 this year. Eagles, 9-win team last year. I think kind of similar. There's no differences on their offense. They're going to have issues with who they throw the football to. Their offensive line is banged up already before even playing a snap. Their defense will be better than it was last year. They probably shouldn't have won 9 last season. They're another one of those teams that's really well coached. They'll probably be an 8 or 9-win team. I don't think they'll fall below 8. I don't think they have the talent to get above 10. So I think they'll be somewhere in between. The Titans, I am not high on the Titans at all. I think last year was a mirage on offense with a bunch of big plays down the field and a couple of those big runs by Henry. I think that they will drop this year to a 7-win team. I don't think that they will take a step forward at all. I think relying on Tannehill is basically going to be a mistake. And then you got the teams that were the best teams from last year. And you look at, who looked to improve and who just, barely added much. And quite frankly, nobody from this group really added anything. Most of these teams were kind of struggling with their salary caps. The Ravens, the Saints, Seahawks, Packers, all these teams kind of struggled with it. The 49ers, I think, will drop down. They were 11 last year. Obviously, they had a great playoff run. I don't see that at all. I envision them more as a 8-win football team. I don't think that they will do that anything much better than that. Chiefs, a 12-win team last year with Mahomes there. He wasn't even there the full season last year. They'll be a 12-win team again this season. Patriots, they're going to run out there with Cam Newton. Who knows what Cam Newton is right now? The rest of their roster is old. It's just a lot of parts thrown together out there. Question is going to be, how awesome is Belichick? How much of a challenge does he see this without Tom Brady, and how can he make it work? They've been devastated by the opt-outs this year in New England as well. I still think they'll win 9 or 10 games. I don't think they'll win 12, but I do think they'll win 9 or 10 next year. Green Bay is not a 13-win football team. I think they would tell you the same thing. Question is Aaron Rodgers going to look at this season as like a referendum on his career and his status in Green Bay? Is there something that goes off with him because they drafted a quarterback that just has him playing out of his mind, you know, turn back the clock 5 years? I don't know if that's possible to do. I think that's the only way that they could be close to the same level of team. I think they obviously have potential to win the division. You know, it's a very weak division. I think they're the best team in the division, but I think the best team in that division may only be 9 or 10 wins. So I think that's really what you're looking at there. Seattle is, I don't know. I just have a tough time there because I feel as if the coaching staff has kind of let certain things go by. You know, and, you know, last year they were at 11. I think I said the 49ers were at 11 as well. And now the 49ers last year were at 13. You know, Seahawks were at 11. I think I flipped the two of them around. You know, Seattle, you know, they, I don't know. It's just so hard with the coaching staff there. They play a different type of football. I feel like than a lot of other teams in the league when they actually have the pieces to play a more modern style. They'll probably be right around the same. That's where they are every year. I just don't think they can take that leap forward. Saints are all in on this season. They won 13 last year. That division could be a bloodbath. I don't think they'll win 13 this year, but I do think they'll be pretty good. I think they'll be an 11 or 12 win team. The Ravens won 14. I think they'll still be a good team. I think they will probably regress a little bit. I think they will, probably be closer to 11 wins. I think Lamar Jackson will improve as a passer, and I think they will be able to add some new wrinkles on that offense. I think some of the running stuff the teams will be a little bit more in tune with this year. I know obviously there's a level of athleticism that Jackson has that you can't necessarily just game plan against. Typically, I think when you see those kind of seasons the next year, you'll see some teams kind of, jump off of that. If I had to choose, what teams I think will win each division, I guess if I had to put money on it, I'd probably choose the Bills in the AFC East, New England maybe as well. I think the team that would surprise me the most would be the Jets if they were to win it, and I would be very pleasantly surprised there. I think the Ravens will probably win the division again. Pittsburgh is the team I think most likely to give them a run for the money. Cincinnati I think would be the least likely. I think the Texans will pretty much walk away with the AFC South. I'd be surprised if the Titans or Colts won that division, and I'd be shocked if the Jaguars won it. Kansas City is obviously the cream of the crop. I think Denver has the best chance to give them a run for the money. I think Oakland's got a good chance as well to at least compete, for the playoffs to some extent. They're going to be a team, if they were to make the playoffs, would do no damage. But I think they'll at least flirt with those low wild card. In the NFC East, I think Dallas should walk away with that division completely. I'd be pretty surprised if Washington or the Giants won it, but I think Dallas, I'd be pretty surprised if they did not win it. Green Bay, I think, is your team in the NFC North. you know, I don't think you really have a bad team in the NFC North. I don't think you have a good team. So I think your winner is going to be, you know, 10 wins probably on the season. South, anyone but the Panthers, but, you know, the Saints are the team, obviously, I favor the most there. I'd be pretty surprised, actually, if Atlanta was able to have that kind of season, too. I think it just is if Tampa Bay gets an amazing performance out of Brady, you know, that'll be an interesting battle between those two teams. But I would favor the Saints. And it wouldn't surprise me if the Saints won this division by 3 or 4 games and the rest of that division just kind of fluctuated back. I think the Seahawks will win the NFC West. I think that, you know, they'll probably win their 11 games and win the West. I think Arizona has the best chance to be an upset team. I'd be very surprised if San Francisco or the Rams were, you know, at the double-digit win level this year. So I think that's where I would stand on those teams as to who's going to win the Super Bowl and all that stuff. Who knows? You know, I'm sure all these predictions are bad enough. You know, it's hard to see a team really being better than Kansas City just because the quarterback is so good. You know, you've got the Saints and the NFC. I just don't see that. You know, they always find some hard luck way to lose. You know, you've got the Seahawks, you know, with Cowboys. You know, the Cowboys could. I think the Cowboys could compete for it. You know, if the Texans get everything together, they have the talent. I just don't see them getting everything together. Baltimore and Pittsburgh could be able to be dangerous. I don't think anyone coming out of the AFC East will be that good. You know, I guess you go chalk and you just go Kansas City. So, all right. Anyway, that is, I think, it for me. I didn't do questions this week because I wasn't sure when I was going to record. So we'll be back next week, hopefully on Friday, and we'll take a look at the first slate of games. We'll get back doing some questions, and hopefully we'll get some more contract information. In the meantime, if you happen to get any contract info that we do not have, you know, feel free to let me know, and, you know, we'll get that stuff online and get everything working out there. So everyone have a great week, and let's hope for a terrific football season that goes the full 16 games plus playoffs this year. Have a good one, everyone.